Genesis chapter 36. Genesis chapter 36. So how many of you are aware of the History Channel show, The Curse of Oak Island? I see Matt shaking his head. Anybody else ever heard of it? Dustin shaking his head. So, The Curse of Oak Island, I look forward to that every week. It's obviously, you know, it's only, I don't know, probably 12, 15, 17 shows every season, and then you got to wait another year before it comes back on. But I always look forward to it at this time of year. It's in its 12th season now, but let me give you kind of a rundown of what it is. So it has to do with two brothers, the Laginas. I think the oldest one is now, I think, probably in his early 70s. But they basically were born and raised in Michigan, and they read an article in Reader's Digest when they were little kids about a treasure, supposedly, that had been buried at a place called Oak Island up in Canada. No, I think it's Nova Scotia. And basically, the way the story goes is back in the 1870s or so, these boys had seen some lights on the island, and so they went over to the island. And what they discovered was a sort of a depression in the land. And so they knew something maybe had been buried there. So they began to dig down. And as they got down, I think it was 10 or 15 feet, they found these logs laid out. And so they removed all the logs, and then they kept digging down. And 10 feet later, there were another set of logs. And they went down about 100 feet or so and came across a stone with some engravings on it. And so they had assumed that maybe something had been buried. Well, over the years, over 200 and some plus years, different individuals have gone to the island and started these massive excavations to try to find, supposedly, this buried treasure. And each one of the individuals, in fact, I think even FDR spent time there actually on the island digging, looking for treasure. And what's been wild about this is all of the different people that have been on the island that have done this type of thing, the excavations, have all found stuff that's rather unexplainable. Different structures and things that didn't align with history. And so the Laginas, Rick, I think, is the... Rick is the oldest one, and Marty's the younger one. Rick has always wanted to go to the island and find it. Well, he was, I think, a postal worker, but his younger brother, Marty, is extremely wealthy. And so he's investing all this money now into basically digging for this treasure. And they're digging big 8-foot, 200, you know, foot holes in the ground. They've excavated whole entire sections. They've bought much of the island. And so every season, or the 12th season, is about what they're finding. And so here's the thing. It's fascinating to watch because of the stuff they're finding, because a lot of it doesn't match or align with normal history. For instance, when people actually traveled here from Europe, and they're finding artifacts from the 1600s on the island, where it's like, how does this stuff get here when they couldn't travel like that back then? It's just wild stuff, right? Well, the other thing about the show is that they've been looking for the treasure now for 12 years. And everything ends with disappointment. They always come up short. And so they finally, they know that the treasure is probably in this area. And so they dig this big 8-foot hole all the way down 200 feet. And it floods with water and they can't get any lower. It's like, okay, we fell short again. Or whatever. And so every time, every season ends with disappointment. They always come up short. But after 12 seasons and what I calculate is somewhere 200 plus hours of watching this show, I'm not giving up now. you can't. You're just totally invested, you know? And now, do I believe there's a treasure there? No, I do believe after watching this. And they've got a real focus on history. It's not just about the treasure. They just love the history of it. And some of it's conspiratorial, the Knights Templar and some of this stuff. But yet there's stuff where you're like, yeah, and they make connections all over the world. They find symbols on the island carved into rock that they find in churches over in Europe, and it's sort of like, wow, this is really bizarre stuff, right? So do I believe they're going to come up with buried treasure at some point? No, because I'm thinking if you buried a treasure, you're probably going to go back and get it, right? But, again, it's sort of like, they get their hopes up, and then every time they fall short. So I think on this week's episode that I saw, they had, again, a big, I don't know what they call it, but it's a 7 or an 8-foot round cylinder that they drive into the ground 200 feet or whatever, and they pull stuff out of the ground. They're pulling up tunnels and all kinds of stuff. You're like, why are these people digging tunnels underground, you know? So they're doing that, and then you're like, they really think this is it. They really think they're going to start pulling up gold. And then it's like, nope. All right, next. You know, so this week was another one of those things where they came up short. And so that really ought to be, this ought to be the curse of Oak Island, how to come up short every time, because that's exactly what seems to be happening. But yet there's still some type of hope out there. Well, today we're coming to the end of another section in Genesis. And the passage is mainly a genealogy of Esau, as Dustin has already alluded to here. Now, whenever I come to genealogies like this, especially you get the book of Numbers, you know, that kind of stuff, I struggle because it's hard to find some practical application when what you have are a list of names that are too difficult to pronounce, that make you feel like you're going to choke and get lost in them. And so I was not looking forward. I almost thought about asking Dustin if he wanted to preach on this passage this morning to see if he could do a better job than me. Yes, that's what he says. Ah, thanks, Dustin. However, as I was looking over these list of names, I began to really think through, Lord, what is the purpose for this, and what can we learn from Esau? And what I came up with was that Esau is a textbook example of somebody who ultimately fell short of God's grace. And it's reflected in his genealogy, and we're going to see that this morning. Especially when we look at that in light of other scriptures and other things that are said about Esau. So today we're going to look at how Esau fell short. I'm going to break it down like I always do into three sections. Just because that's what I was taught in seminary, you know. Every sermon has an introduction, conclusion, and three main points. That's what they tell me. So we're going to break it down into three different sections today. The first is that Esau built a sizable family, but he fell short because he had married Canaanite women. Second, we're going to see that Esau became wealthy and acquired great possessions, but he fell short because he moved away from home, and we'll see why, what I mean by that in a minute. And then lastly, Esau grew into a great nation, but one that ultimately became an enemy of God and his people, and again, he fell short. And so we're going to look at this genealogy today, and I'm going to struggle through some of the names. As I read some of these names, if you find me starting to choke or pass out because I can't pronounce them, somebody come up here and give me some CPR or something, or help me out. So I'm going to slaughter these names. I know I will. But bear with me on that, because I think you'll find this interesting as we look at these. I'm hoping what you walk away with and go, I'm glad we didn't skip the genealogies. Okay, because that's easy to do. So I'm hoping that you'll walk away going, wow, we can learn that from genealogies. So let's look at this first part. It's the first five verses of chapter 36. Esau built a sizable family, but he fell short because he married Canaanite women. Let's look at the first five verses. Now, these are the records of the genealogy of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite, and, let's look at this, Oholibamah. I'm just going to say Obama. Okay? Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, and the granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite. Also Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. Adah bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel. And Oholibamah bore Jeush, and Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. I was going to ask Matt if he wanted to read that in the Hebrew today, but probably a little bit easier seeing it in the Hebrew than the English in some respects. But anyway, these are the names. This is the beginning. It says that this is the genealogy of Esau, or otherwise known as Edom. Now, let's look at this. It's not really clear exactly how many wives Esau had. It's either four or three or six, and there's controversy over this because nobody seems to be able to agree. Back in Genesis chapter 26, verse 34, we're told that Esau married two wives. Those are likely his two initial wives. Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, we're told, and then Basemath, who's the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Those are his first two wives. That's pretty clear, scripturally speaking, again. That's from Genesis chapter 26. Then in Genesis chapter 29, we're told that he married a third wife, Ishmael's daughter, Mahalath. That would suggest that Esau had three wives. The two Hittite wives and then the daughter of Ishmael. And that would seem to match what we find here in this chapter, except the names don't seem to match. Let's look at this real quickly here. If you look at, I think it's verse 2 here, Esau took wives from the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Olibama, the daughter of Anan, the granddaughter of Zibeon the Hivite. Well, those names are different than what we saw earlier. Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, this was likely a second name for Basemath. Sometimes they had more than one name, and so it may be that this Ada, daughter of Elon the Hittite, was also Basemath from Genesis chapter 26. And the reason for that is they're both the daughter of Elon the Hittite. So it's either two separate women with two separate names because they both had the same father, or it's the same person with two different names. That's the general consensus, is that it's the same person with two different names. The other one there, the Aholibama, the daughter of Ahan, the granddaughter of the Zibeonite, the Hivite, also appears to be an additional wife, not one that's mentioned anywhere else. There's no other names given for her. It gets a little bit confusing. And then lastly here, we see Basemath, daughter of Ishmael. That's probably another name for Mahalath from Genesis chapter 28. Now, did I thoroughly confuse you yet? Basically, let me just say it this way. At this point, if we had nothing else to go by, it would seem he has three wives. Okay? And the wives had more than one name because their fathers are the same, etc. Okay. So we went from the initial two wives to maybe three wives now that he has, some of with, again, double names. But actually, when we look at this passage now compared with Genesis 28 and Genesis chapter 26, my conclusion is that he likely had four wives, and that two of those four wives had different names. And that's why we get the confusion. That's why some say he had six, because two of the wives had two names. It really wasn't two wives, it was four. And again, so let me just, if you want to write them down, I'll just give them to you here. One of them was likely named Judith. She was the daughter of a man named Beri the Hittite. Then we had two daughters named Basemath. The daughter of Elon the Hittite. She was also called Ada. And then we had the daughter of Ishmael, Basemath. She was also called Mahalath. So we have those three. And then the last one, Olibaman, the daughter of Ahan, appears to be the fourth wife. So again, not everybody's going to agree. Some say three wives, some say six wives. I split the difference of sorts. It appears to me that he probably had four wives. And again, some of the confusion is because the wives had more than one name. Now, according to the text here, verses 4 and 5 tells us that he had five sons. So he had four wives, and then by those four wives had five sons. Ada bore a son named Eliphaz. Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, bore a son named Reuel. And then lastly, Aholibama bore three sons, Joash, Jalam, and Korah. Now, is that important that you memorize all these names? This is not one of those Bible memory verses you have to memorize. Okay? What we learn from this is that he had four wives and he had at least five sons. This is a fairly sizable family. Now, it's not the 12 or 13 children that Jacob had, but if you think Abraham only had two, right? So what we basically see here is that he had a fairly sizable family. He had progeny. Now, as I look at this, though, you can generally tell when you look at a passage which verses are the ones that we're really supposed to pay attention to. They stand out. They're emphasized. And I believe that that's what we find in verse 2 when it says, Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. I believe that is supposed to be the primary verse of this genealogy here. You might remember back in Genesis chapter 26, verse 35, that when this is first mentioned, that he took wives from the daughters of Canaan, that it brought bitterness, it says, to Isaac and to Rebekah. So it's not a good thing. It brought distress to his family because he had taken wives from the land they were living in, from the Canaanites. It was so bad, if you remember back in Genesis chapter... Go ahead and turn there, Genesis chapter 27. Genesis chapter 7, you remember what Rebekah had said about these Canaanite women? Genesis chapter 27, verse 46. She's crying out to her husband, to Isaac, and she says in verse 46, I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. Those are Esau's wives, the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like these two women that my other son has married, if he takes them from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? She was in distress. These two daughters of Canaan had brought her and her husband tremendous stress, so much so that the best way to read that and understand that is she despised her life. Have you ever known somebody like that who has a mother-in-law or a father-in-law that just brings so much distress and anxiety that they just can't stand it? I know some like that. I've been very fortunate in my life. I think Amy is very fortunate in having my parents. It's not just because I love my parents. My parents have always been loved by my friends and others. In fact, at my dad's funeral, people from high school, friends that I no longer keep in contact with, came to my dad's funeral. Amy inherited that. I was blessed by her family. I don't have the stress that some of my friends have with their in-laws. Now, hope that doesn't sound terrible. But in this particular instance, these Canaanite wives brought tremendous distress to Rebekah and to Isaac. And the text tells us here in chapter 36 that he took his wives from these people, from these Canaanites. Esau taking wives from among the pagan daughters of Canaan stands in stark contrast to what both Abraham and Isaac demanded of their own children. Look at Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24, look at Abraham. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord of God of heaven and God of earth that you shall not take a wife from my son, from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac. He forbid Isaac and his servant from getting a wife for Isaac from the Canaanite women. Absolutely forbid it. Well, this is something that Isaac apparently took to heart, because look at what happens in Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28. Look at verses 1 and 2. So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padam Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. So both Abraham and Isaac understood the dangers in taking a wife from among the Canaanites. But apparently, Esau didn't get the message. And so I think the verse we're supposed to really see and understand, or the one that is supposed to jump out from this, is that in spite of the fact that Esau had built a fairly decent-sized family, had multiple wives with multiple children, his grave mistake was taking his wives from among the Canaanites. So what's our takeaway with that? There's no question that when God called Abraham out of the land of Ur and settled him in Canaan, that his intent was for Abraham to be in the land, but not of the land. Did you get that? He called him into the land, but he wanted him to be in the land, but he did not want him to be of the land. God intended for Abraham and his family to live among the pagans of Canaan, but to in some respects remain separate. Abraham understood this, which is why he demanded that Isaac's wife must not be taken from the daughters of Canaan. Jacob seemed to understand it as well. He was obedient to Isaac when it came to not taking a wife himself from the Canaanites. However, Esau, again, didn't get the message. In the same way, I think God intends us to live in the world, but we are not to be of the world. Paul warned the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. He says, do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? Now, Oftentimes, when we think of that verse, we think of marriage. That's not the particular context that Paul is referring to, but it does apply. We are not supposed to yoke ourselves together with unbelievers. And you can take that in a variety of ways. Some will take that as far as to say that we shouldn't have non-Christian friends. I don't believe that's the case. You can't support that in the Scripture. Some take that to mean we shouldn't go into business with unsaved. And that's one of those areas where there's probably some dangers in doing that. Now, is it prohibited by the Scriptures? It's hard to make that call. But there are certainly, when you partner up with somebody who's unsaved, they may choose to run a business differently than you. And what happens when you have a difference of opinion on how to run your business? That could be a danger, right? But it certainly applies to marriage. It should serve as a warning. That's why Paul warned the Ephesians to walk in a manner worthy of our calling. But he goes on, he says, don't become partakers. Don't yoke yourself to unbelievers. Don't join them, he says, in their unfruitful deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Esau should be a warning, I think, for each one of us. It should be a warning for Christians. He's symbolic, I think, of many Christians today who not only live in the world, but they've chosen to be of the world. They've married Canaanite women, if I can use that symbolically. I was talking to Dustin and Matt a few weeks ago, and I generally do hate to do this, but I think that it's, I don't want to be somebody who is always calling out others. You know, we're all sinners, and so if I point my finger at another pastor, that's a dangerous thing to do sometimes because I'm not perfect either, right? However, there are times where it's appropriate to call others out and say, is this really appropriate? In part because it should remind us that we shouldn't be like that, right? But we've got to be careful and gracious in the way that we do it. Well, I came across, there's a very large church in Dayton. In fact, it's one of the largest churches in America. And they bought a bunch of, they bought a huge chunk, or at least a huge chunk of the Dayton Mall and moving in. And so I was just curious. And so I went to their website and I looked up and I noticed that for their main pastor, as part of his bio, he included a statement about really loving to drink bourbon and to smoke stogies. Now, here's the thing. I don't believe the Bible condemns alcohol in general. We're told not to get drunk, but if somebody wants to have a beer at home and can do it responsibly, I'm not going to judge them for that because I don't think I can do that scripturally. Paul, even when it came to eating meat sacrificed to idols, he said, do it in your own home. Don't necessarily do it in front of others to cause them to stumble because everybody has their own conviction. So I'm somebody who, you know what, if you want to have a drink at home, I'm not going to condemn you for that. I don't choose to do it myself, partly because I don't like alcohol. I just never have acquired a taste for it. Now, does that mean that I will never, every once in a while at home at Christmas, Mom may make a cranberry slush, and I may have a little bit of that? But, do I want to advertise that on a website to people? And that's the trouble, the concern. Well, then I got to the second pastor, the lead pastor of one of their churches, and the same type of thing. Love to do the bourbon. Love to smoke stogies. Now, why is that a concern, and why do I point that out? And I don't know, maybe I think Matt and Dustin kind of looked at it the same way that I did. Maybe, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but it was one of those things like, do we have a problem with them wanting to do that in the privacy of their own home, or does it come across as, look how worldly we are. We're just like you. The world does this, and we fit right in. That's the impression you get when you advertise that. And unfortunately, we've seen through the whole seeker-sensitive movement that started back in the 1970s with Robert Schuller and then ultimately Willow Creek, this idea of, well, if we make ourselves look like the world, then the world will be attracted to us. The problem with that is we're not to be like the world. We're supposed to stand out. We're supposed to be in the world but not of the world. And so as I look at Esau here and I think to myself, you know, God blessed him with this great family, but unfortunately he built the family the wrong way. He built it with Canaanite wives who no doubt would influence him and his children. I think about Solomon. You know, they weren't supposed to marry the pagans. Solomon did it, not just once, not just twice, 700 times, and then he added an additional 300 concubines. And what's the last thing we learn about Solomon? It says, he forsook God. Why? Because his wives turned his heart away. when we decide to marry the world, when we decide to partner with the world, when we decide we want to be like the world, what happens? It turns our heart away from the Lord. That was Esau's problem. Let's move on. Second thing I want to see here is that Esau became wealthy and acquired great possessions, but he fell short ultimately because he moved away from home. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute here, but let's read verses 6 through 8. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and he went to another land away from his brother Jacob. Their property had become too great for them to live together, and the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. Back in chapter 35, when Jacob returned to Canaan, we learned that Esau had been living in Seir for a little while, which is further to the south. It was outside the land of Canaan. But we also learned that Esau had become fairly successful. He had become fairly wealthy. When he came to meet Jacob, he met him with 400 men. That's a sizable group of men. When Jacob ultimately offered him 550 animals, a substantial flock, Esau basically said, No, I don't need it. God has dealt graciously with me, and I have everything that I needed. So he obviously was in no want, had more than enough. How many of us would turn down a sizable gift unless we had more than enough ourselves? And that's what we see with Esau, is that he was fairly wealthy. He had acquired great possessions. He was a powerful man. In fact, we're going to see in a little bit, he had conquered all of Seir. Had taken over a nation. Now, we look at this here, and what we learn in this is, this takes place, this episode in verses 6 through 8 takes place after Isaac's death, which was about 20 years after Jacob had returned home. So it appears that even though initially Esau was living in Seir to the south when Jacob came back to the land, at some point, I think the only conclusion we can make is that Esau moved back home for a period of time. Because by the time we come to this passage, after Isaac was dead, it says that they were living together. They were living in the land. But their flocks had grown so much so that they couldn't stay in the same area together. That's only possible if Esau had moved back home. Because they're living together. And their flocks now have grown so much that the land can't sustain both Esau's flocks and Jacob's flocks. But notice that it tells us here that because the land couldn't sustain them, that Esau left home and he moved to a land away from his brother Jacob, which ultimately is the land of Seir. He went back down to Seir. Now, why is this important? Let me ask a question. You all know how big Israel is. Not just today's Israel, but Israel in the Old Testament. Sizable, bigger than what it is today. Do you think that it wasn't possible that two individuals could have flocks and live in that land? Do you think there wasn't enough land in Canaan? They couldn't stay where they were at. They were in the southern part. They were near Beersheba. And it's probably true that in that little area, their flocks had grown so big that they couldn't stay in that same area. But it didn't demand that Esau leave the land of Canaan altogether. The land is much bigger than that. It could have sustained them. But he chose to move away to a land far away from his brother, Jacob. Why is this important? I think it's important because clearly the land here, when it says they moved to a land away, means outside of Canaan. But you see, Canaan represented the place of God's blessings. It's the land of promise. Now, rightfully so, it belonged to Jacob, but that didn't mean that Esau couldn't still live in the land. In fact, when we look at Israel, God did not say that foreigners couldn't live in the land. Now, when they first conquered the land, he had them clear the land. But foreigners could come in the land, and there was actually segments of the law that dictated that they could live there. He could have stayed in the land of Canaan. He just needed to move to a place that had plenty of room for him. But instead, he chose to move away from the land that God had promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Nowhere in the scriptures does God say, I mandate that Esau move. Now, he does say elsewhere that he gave him the land of Seir, which I believe was a blessing given to him after he chose to leave because of God's promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. I think ultimately, God blessed his brother in the land of Seir. But what we ultimately see here is that he just decided to leave. When Abraham sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac, he warned the servant not to take Isaac away from the land of Canaan. Think about this. Go to Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24, verses 6 and 7. Then Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there, back home. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth and spoke to me, who swore to me, saying to your descendants, I will give this land. He will send his angel before you and you will take a wife for my son there. In other words, I will bring you back, or I want him in the land. Jacob needs to stay, or Isaac needs to stay in the land, because that's where God would ultimately bless. When Jacob fled Canaan because of Esau's threats against him, God promised he would also bring him back to the land. Verse chapter 28, verse 13 says, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and your seed. So again, he told not just Abraham that the land would become Isaac's. He told Isaac that the land would ultimately become Jacob's. After Jacob got waylaid in Padan Aram, for 20 years, God commanded him to return back to Canaan. Genesis chapter 31, verse 3. Then Yahweh said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kin. I will be with you. When Jacob stopped halfway, settled in Shechem for a decade, got stuck there, God once again commanded him to return home, reminded him of the promise regarding the land. Chapter 35, verse 12 says this, and the land which I gave to Abraham and to Isaac I will give to you, and I will give this land to your seed after you. So the land of Canaan was part of God's purpose, his redemptive plan. It's important. And while his covenant was specifically with Jacob and not Esau, it's striking that Esau was so willing to move away from that. It's land that God had promised his grandfather, Abraham, his father Isaac, and his brother Jacob. Esau should have known this is the land of promise. Wouldn't it have made more sense that if Esau wanted to be blessed of God, that he would say, I want to stay right here. In fact, in this passage, it even says that the Lord blessed Esau in the land of Canaan by multiplying his possessions. He became wealthy living in the land. Should Esau not have said, this is where God's blessings are? This is the family heritage. The Lord has promised my father and my grandfather and even my brother that this is where he would be. I want to be there. I want to be in the center of what God does. But instead, I'll even have my own life down here in Seir. Esau, again, should serve as a warning to us. By his own admission, God had blessed him, made him wealthy, gave him possessions, gave him everything he needed while he was living in the land of Canaan. However, the one thing that he didn't have was an appreciation for God, his purpose, his plan, his promises, his blessings. How many Christians live the same way today? They enjoy the possessions. They enjoy building wealth. They love what God has done for them here. But they show little regard for his purpose, his plan, and the promises when it comes to spiritual matters of the gospel. How many young people today symbolically have moved away from home? Walked away from their faith. I actually watched a video the other day. It was one of those videos where you have to really be careful because you might misinterpret it. But it was a guy who posted a short video, and didn't have any words to it. Didn't speak, but it was just words on the screen. And he basically said, "What happened when I divorced my wife and I left the church?" And then a second later, this woman jumps into the picture and gives him this big hug. And so my first thought when I saw that was, really? So you divorce your first wife, you leave the church, now all things are happy and good because you got another wife. Well, what I discovered was he had remarried his first wife. In other words, it was a very positive thing. He was saying, look, I divorced my wife, I left the church, I deconstructed is what he said. But he's like, but then God got a hold of my heart. And he restored my marriage, and he brought me back to the faith. And so I had to stop and go, wow, I could have misinterpreted that. And maybe that was the reason he did it the way he did, was to be provocative and make people sort of come back. But it made me start thinking about the deconstruction movement that we see today. How many have abandoned the faith that they were growing up? How many have moved away from home? Just fought light of God and his promises. And I would say that many of those still think they're just fine. But they didn't take the faith that they grew up in seriously. They're much like Esau, who was so easy to move away, leave the land of promise, not give it a second thought. Our churches are filled with stuff like that today, where we not only have, I believe, many people who are unsaved, but many who probably are saved, but have abandoned sound theology, a sound understanding of the scriptures. They just, it's so easy to walk away from that stuff. It's no longer important. God is who I make. And I think Esau is a good example of that, and it should be something that warns us very seriously. I'm reminded, and I think Dustin and I were talking about this, just a brief little comment this morning about, or was it that, or was it, maybe it was Katie and I were talking in the car, about Paul, when he was working with Timothy, reminded Timothy, it was actually you and I, about the things that he had learned from Paul, and Paul tells him, don't abandon these things. Which partly means that they probably hadn't become Timothy's yet in the sense that he had studied all on his own and they were now his convictions. And Paul recognized that. He was a mentor, a discipler to Timothy, and there were certain things that he shared with Timothy, and he told him, hold tightly to these things. Don't walk away. Don't think light of them. I'd do that myself as I think about Pastor Krenz in that, where I don't always agree with Pastor Krenz on every theological point. Every pastor, I think, has issues. We're not perfect. We're still studying. Kimberly was asking me a lot of questions last night through text about hell and all this other stuff. And so one of the things I texted back to her this morning was, it makes my heart happy that you ask theological questions, ask Bible questions. And I told her, I said, I pray for you every morning that God grows you in not just your knowledge of the scriptures, but your relationship with him. And so when you ask these things, it blesses my heart. But then I texted her, I said, keep praying for me because I still need to grow in my knowledge and my relationship with Christ. So continue to pray. But I know that she's 22 and much of what she believes is because she was taught it. But she's learning, she's listening, she's growing and making this her own. But my hope and prayer is that she doesn't walk away from those things. Esau just too easily walked away. He ultimately fell short. Let's look at the last piece. The last piece is that Esau grew into a great nation, but again, fell short. Because ultimately, this great nation became an enemy of God and his people. Now, verses 9 through 43, that's a lot of verses. It's a lot of names. I think I would probably run out of breath and you'd find me collapsed on the floor if I had to read through all of these this morning. I'm being obviously a little facetious here, but I'm going to forego reading these. If you want to read through these names here, but I'm going to summarize them for you. Verses 6 through 14 repeat the names of Esau's sons. Verses 19 or 15 through 19 provides the names of Esau's grandsons. And the important thing there is, ultimately, his grandsons become 14 chiefs or tribal leaders, meaning leaders of little clans. So the important thing there, as we look through those names in verses 15 through 19, are just the fact that there's 14 chiefs that are listed there. Verses 31 through 39 provides a list of 8 kings that all descended from Esau. They ruled the nation of Edom for 8 generations before Israel got its first king. So we not only have these sons, but then we have these chiefs, and then we have these kings over at least 8 generations. Verses 40 through 43 provides another list of Esau's descendants, who 2 of which are repeated, but 7 are all new. So what you basically end up with in verses 9 through 43 are this long list of descendants, of chiefs, and of kings, and of sons, and of grandsons, and grandsons of grandsons, that ultimately became the nation that we now know was called Edom. So Esau grew into this great nation. Now, in the middle of these lists is another list revealing the descendants of Seir the Horite. The reason that's important is because they ruled the land of Seir prior to Esau and his descendants conquering it and taking it over. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, and then Joshua 24, verse 4, states that God gave the land of Seir to Esau's descendants as their possession. Ultimately, it's a reference to them conquering it. In other words, Esau and his descendants moved down to Seir, and they became so powerful that they overcame the local residents, and God did that. So he gave Seir to him. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 12 states, "The Horites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of the possessions which the Lord gave them." And so ultimately what we learn from this is that Esau became a great nation, the nation of Edom. He even conquered a nation, became powerful, authoritative, took over a whole entire area. That's pretty amazing. Now the tragedy in all of that, though, is that even though God had given the land of Edom to Esau and his descendants, even though they had become a great nation, they were always at odds with Israel. In fact, they were ultimately Israel's enemy. This is something God foretold back in Genesis 25 when he said, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." That was a foreshadowing of what would happen between Israel and the land of Edom, between Jacob and his brother Esau and their descendants. Edom's hatred towards Israel was first revealed in their refusal to allow the Israelites to pass through them during the Exodus. Turn to Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. Jump down to verse 14. "From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. 'Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us.'" There's a reference there to all their time in Egypt. "And the fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are in Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through the field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway and turning to the right, or not turning to the right or the left, until we pass through your territory." In other words, what Moses is doing is saying, "We just need to pass through your land." He references the fact that Edom is the brother of Israel. They're related. He pours out his heart that, look at the way we've been mistreated. Give us some grace. Let us just walk through the land. It won't cost you anything. We won't take of anything. We'll just pass through. Look at verse 18. "Edom, however, said to him, 'You shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you.' Again, the sons of Israel said to him, 'We will go by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else.' But he said, 'You shall not pass through.' And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him." And so Edom was Israel's enemy from the very beginning. In fact, their hatred continued throughout all of their history and culminated in their forces joining with Babylon when they attacked Judah and carried them off into captivity. They were not only an enemy of Israel, but ultimately were judged by God because of it. At least seven prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, and Malachi, all of them prophesied the destruction of Edom and God's judgment against them because of their treatment of Israel. In fact, the entire book of Obadiah is dedicated to God's judgment against Edom. Now, why is that important? Esau goes from living in the land, being under God's blessing, if you will, and reaping the rewards of living in the land, leaves, goes away, becomes this great nation, but ultimately becomes an enemy of God himself. So what's our takeaway with that? The last thing the Bible says about Esau is found in Hebrews chapter 12. Turn there with me. And it becomes ultimately the theme of all of these verses we've looked at today. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 15 through 17. See to it that no one comes up short of the grace of God. That's the theme. See to it that nobody comes up short of the grace of God. That no root of bitterness spring up, causing trouble, and by it many be defiled. That there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought for it with tears. What's the main point of that passage? It's that Esau came up short of the grace of God. If you want to know whether or not Esau was saved, you get your answer right here. He came up short of the grace of God. Now think about that for a minute. Grace is a gift. It's offered at no cost. But yet Esau fell short of that. How do you fall short of a gift? But Esau did. The great tragedy of Esau's life is that he had everything the world had to offer. He had wealth, he had possessions, even his own kingdom. But he was immoral, he was godless, and because of that, he came up short of the grace of God. He found no place for repentance. It says, therefore, he was rejected by God, ultimately making himself an enemy of God. Again, I think about the church. There are many within the walls of the church who are like Esau. They have everything the world can offer, but they find no place for repentance, continue to live immoral and godless lives, metaphorically marrying women of Canaan, and ultimately they will fall short of God's grace. My hope and prayer is that it doesn't happen to us. I'm not talking about loss of salvation. I remember looking at the parable of sheep and the goats, where Jesus is looking at the goats, who all think they're saved, all think they were doing great things for Jesus, but he says, I didn't know you. Harsh words. When I was in high school, you all know I was a swimmer, I almost always swam the same exact three events. I was a distance swimmer. I always swam the 200 freestyle, the 500 freestyle, and I always anchored the last relay. In 3 years of high school swimming, there's only one time that I ever swam anything else. This particular meet down in a place, I don't know if it was Sturgeon Bay or Bayport or someplace. And I kind of noticed on the sheet that I was supposed to swim butterfly that particular day. I'm not a butterfly, or never was. But hey, do my part, right? So I remember getting up on the blocks. Remember the gun going off? I hit that water and I just started to sprint all out, swimming butterfly. Got to the wall, did my turn, raced back, you know, and I hit that wall and put my hand on it, and looked around, and man, I was so far ahead of everybody else. And I stopped and I was pretty excited because I'm not a butterflyer. And all of a sudden I noticed all of my teammates on the side yelling and screaming at me. The coach yelling and screaming at me, what are you doing? What are you doing? Get going, get going. I'm like, what, what? And then I heard somebody say, it's 100, you idiot. huh, I came up short. I stopped swimming after 50 yards. Now, in my excuse, in my defense, summer was only 50 yards, not 100. Well, I'm a distancer. I didn't pay attention to the 100 freestyler dudes. I hated butterfly. So I stopped after 50 yards. Came up short. And as a result, I was disqualified. When we look at Esau, I think what we see in this genealogy is this individual that, again, he built this family, but he was married to the world. He had all this great wealth, but he walked away from home, walked away from the land of promise. It was so easy to do. He was built into this great, powerful nation, but ultimately became an enemy of God. All three of those led to him falling short of the grace of God. And again, that is a staggering thing. How do you fall short of a gift? I think Esau serves as an example. Everything we find in the Old Testament is a tutor to lead us to Christ, and we ought to take that seriously. Now, I don't question anybody's salvation here. But you know, it's interesting when you look at the Scriptures, there's the constant reminder to endure, to finish the course, to run the race, to try to get over the finish line. It isn't done until we see Christ or we die and we face Him in paradise. And may we not fall short of the grace of God because we do what Esau did. And unfortunately, like I said, the churches are filled, I think. And it'd be easy for us to point our finger at them and not sit back and go, you know what? May that not be true with me. You know, I'm somebody who's convinced that the proof of our salvation isn't in what we say, what we do, in our theology. Those are all important. The proof of our faith is where we end up. Isn't it? If you want to really know if you're saved, you'll know when you get to the end, when you cross the finish line. That's the ultimate proof, is it not? Because there are many who are going to say, I'm saved! But they're going to fall short of the grace of God and realize they're not. Because the real proof of our faith is ultimately not falling short of God's grace, but inheriting it. That was Esau's problem. He probably thought all along, he's just fine. But he fell short of the grace of God. It may not be true of us. Amen?